I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Today, smart nutrition with the nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle. Artificial sweeteners aren't just in diet sodas anymore. They're in many of the processed foods we eat, and a new study shows consumption of fake sugars is soaring among the very young, middle schoolers, and even toddlers. Plus, the never-ending debate between low-fat versus low-carb diets and using tech to tighten the belt. How apps and mindful eating can help us eat right and stay fit. Then, theater critic J. Wynn Russick stops by, as she does every Thursday, with her weekly review. Beautiful, the Carole King musical is ringing the rafters at the Hippodrome this week. But does the earth move? We'll find out on Midday, right after the news. Pass the peas, indeed. Little James Brown to get us kicked off here on Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. It's time now for another installment of Smart Nutrition. The nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle, is here. She's an author and a licensed nutritionist who joins us on Midday every other month and who blogs at nutritionovereasy.com. Good to see you. How you doing?
Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
So we're going to talk about a few apps that are supposed to help us in our battle of the bulges, and we're going to take up the long-running argument over low-carb versus low-fat diets. That's kind of like Hatfields and McCoys go to the grocery store. We're also going to start by, by talking about the big jump in consumption of artificial sweeteners by kids. This is kind of scary. So we're going to talk about that in just a second. But if you'd like to join in and tell us what you're feeding your kids when it comes to artificial sweeteners, we'd be delighted to hear from you here on Midday. 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So the first thing that folks have to be hip to is that artificial sweeteners are not just in diet sodas.
Anymore. Right. Yeah. So this finding that you're referencing, they were just looking at the consumption patterns of all different kinds of things in the American diet. And not surprisingly, they found that across the board, we're eating about twice as much artificial sweetener now as we were 15 years ago. But the thing that really got my attention about this is that filtered all the way down to the very youngest children, our two-year-olds. 20% of our two-year-olds are consuming artificial sweeteners on a daily or a near-daily basis. And to me, that's a big concern. But I think you're right. I think one of the reasons that this has come to be is that it's not just about diet soda anymore. We are seeing artificial sweeteners being added to all kinds of foods that you might not expect. Things like that you're feeding to your kids. Things like yogurt or granola bars or cereal, fruit juice drinks. Anything pretty much that's being promoted as being lower in sugar, which is a very popular claim right now, is very likely to contain artificial sweeteners. And I think that's part of the reason that we're seeing this big jump.
So if a two-year-old is drinking like an apple juice box, is that artificially sweetened these days? Is it naturally sweetened because apples are sweet? I don't know. How does that work now? It's been a while since I've had a two-year-old, so I haven't paid attention to the labels.
If it's 100% apple juice, then that's exactly what it is. But there are now a bunch of fruit blends, you know, fruit punches or, orange juice drinks where they're not 100% fruit juice. And some of them are marketed as being lower in sugar. Now, these may be being pitched at adults who are looking to reduce their sugar consumption, but they're definitely trickling down to our kids as well in ways that parents may not be completely aware of.
So one of the studies says that there's been a 300% increase in the consumption of sort of fake sugar. Is referring to our artificial sweetener as a fake sugar?
They call them
That's a 300% increase since 1999.
So yeah, over the last non-caloric sweeteners years. Or something. We're talking about things like Splenda and Equal and Saccharin, those kinds of artificial sweeteners. Much more recently, we've seen some more quote-unquote natural non-caloric sweeteners that are made with stevia or monk fruit. But this big jump that we're seeing, and most of the use in the mainstream grocery association, is still those older artificial sweeteners.
And the reason is, I assume, because people don't want to consume sugar. So they're saying if I have an artificial sugar,
The assumption is that it's better.
Better, right.
And we've heard, maybe not so much.
Well, you know, we've had this steady drumbeat of public health messaging about how we're eating too much sugar, we have too many calories from added sugars, we have to get the sugar out of our diets. And so I think that, yes, people look at these sugar-free foods, these artificially sweetened foods, as being a better alternative. But I think we may be trading benefits, some benefits and risks, for other benefits and risks. I wouldn't necessarily say we're jumping from the frying pan into the fire, but possibly from a frying pan into an equally hot frying pan.
I mean, is it possible that artificial sugar is in some ways just as bad as real sugar?
Perhaps in different ways. So artificial sweetener is not adding calories to the diet, and that could be seen as a good thing, empty calories. It's not going to have an effect on your blood sugar, and that could be very beneficial for people who are concerned about their blood sugar, people with type 2 diabetes. But what we've seen is that it does seem to have an effect on the population of your gut bacteria. And we've talked about this before. This is the big topic right now in nutrition science, is the microbiome, the beneficial bacteria that live in our guts and call the shots in some, you know, a lot of very surprising ways. So these non-caloric sweeteners do appear to have an effect on the makeup of our gut bacteria in ways that might actually be promoting weight gain. And diabetes, perversely enough.
Yeah, that is perverse, isn't it? Because that's just sort of counterintuitive.
Right.
Yeah.
So it took a while, you know, for a long time, people were saying, like, look, there's no way that an artificial sweetener could be promoting obesity because there's no calories in it. There's no sugar. And now we do have a smoking gun in the shape of this effect on the intestinal bacteria. But that brings us back to the kids, right? Children, their digestive system and that microbiome is immature and developing very rapidly and profoundly affected by diet. And I just hate the thought that we are inoculating our two-year-olds with foods that may be having a very long-lasting effect on their, not just their digestive health, but on their metabolisms. And, you know, these could be lifelong consequences. So I'd like to invoke the precautionary principle here and say, yes, we don't want to be giving our kids all that sugar. I think we want to be equally cautious about giving them a lot of artificial sweeteners.
So is it the case that sugar, real sugar, does not have any deleterious effect on the microbiome and that only the artificial sweeteners have a deleterious effect? I mean, there's other deleterious effects for sugar, but I mean, people were drinking, you know, regular Coke instead of Diet Coke, was the regular Coke maybe putting on the pounds but leaving their gut bacteria alone?
I wouldn't necessarily assume that. Pretty much everything that we eat does affect the profile of bacteria in the intestines. Basically, they eat what we eat. And so, you know, whatever we're putting into our bodies, it's having an influence. And diets that are high in sugar do affect the impact of the gut bacteria. It was just sort of an unsuspected effect for these non-caloric sweeteners because we just thought of them as being kind of inert, you know, just sort of nothing, that there was a free pass there. And now I think we have enough information to see it's not a free pass. And I don't think that we need to be afraid of, you know, small occasional consumption of either food, you know, a little bit of sugar, or, you know, if your kid picks up your diet soda and takes a sip, no need to freak out. But I think that, you know, both of these are things that we don't want to have being a regular staple of a child's diet or an adult's diet.
So the fact that these sweeteners now are pervade so many foods, it's not just diet sodas. When you see on the label sugar-free, that could mean, obviously, that it has non-caloric sweeteners, right?
Yeah.
I mean, what does that label mean anymore?
I've gotten burned a couple of times where I've bought something without reading the label carefully that said sugar-free, and then I taste it, and it's sweet. And sure enough, I flip over that. So sugar-free doesn't necessarily mean unsweetened. But I think the even more tricky area is when you see foods that are lower in sugar, reduced sugar. That almost sounds like they've just taken some of the sugar out, so it's not so darn sweet. But very often they've replaced it with an artificial sweetener. Now maybe it's half sugar and half artificial sweetener, and that might not be quite as obvious to consumers.
Is there what's the the ratio of amount of these artificial sweeteners. Like, for example, is there lots more artificial sweeteners in a Diet Coke than there would be in a granola bar? I mean, in other words, do you have to eat 50 granola bars to get the same amount of this non-caloric sweetener that you would consume in the diet sodas? Do you have any
idea? No. The mass of these non-caloric sweeteners is super tiny. So it just takes a tiny little grain of sucralose or aspartame or something to sweeten where it might take a couple of teaspoons of sugar. But I have sort of calculated the equivalence. And if you're trying to keep your sugar intake to less than 25 grams a day, then I would suggest that's the equivalent of maybe 3 or 4 packets of the, you know, the pink packet, the blue packet, the green packet, whatever you're seeing.
Huh. So the bottom line is water's a better bet for everybody, right?
Well, right.
But is a two-year-old going to say, Mommy, can I have some more water? I mean, the two-year-old's going to say, Mommy or Daddy, can I have some more apple juice, right?
Right. And it's up to parents to decide how much sweet beverages, whether it's fruit juice or anything else, you know, is healthy for their kids. I think teaching our kids to drink water would be a habit that would stand them in good stead for a lifetime.
Just generally speaking, right?
Yeah.
But if you're dieting, for example, and your lifestyle heretofore includes drinking regular Coke or regular Pepsi, it's still a good idea to switch to Diet Coke or Diet Pepsi, right? I mean, it's better than the regular stuff. As a general rule, is it not?
I think you would have to weigh that out for yourself, that substituting a diet soda for a regular soda, yes, that's going to save you 180 calories or something. But I don't think that it becomes, you know, a consequence-free choice. And, you know, paradoxically, because they are zero calories, I think a lot of dieters say, like, well, the great thing is I can have 6
right.
diet sodas. It's going to get me through the day because I can't have anything else. And then I think that the potential for concern is magnified.
Yeah, and it's certainly drinking or eating products that have these non-caloric sweeteners does not protect against obesity.
Well, no.
The old-fashioned rules still apply when it comes to protecting against obesity, right?
Well, unfortunately, what we can see quite clearly is the more of these products you consume, the more likely you are to be obese. Now, people have argued in the past, well, that's because the people who are overweight are the ones that are choosing the sugar-free foods in the first place. But now we have some research to suggest, no, actually, there may be some degree of causal effect here. So I would just, you know, consume them in moderation.
Yeah. Monica Reinagle is the Nutrition Diva. It's Smart Nutrition here on Midday Today. We are taking your calls at 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Before we take a break, Monica, let's talk a little bit about this age-old debate, the low-carb camp versus the low-fat camp. This debate continues to rage. When you talk about people who are on diets, they just, the ones who succeed, just swear on a stack of Bibles by whatever way they've decided to do it. So it's, I mean, I'm in my own experience with friends and stuff who've done this, I have probably equal numbers of people who swear off carbs or swear off, you know, fat, and they all seem to be doing pretty good.
Well, and this is a debate that also rages in the nutrition research community. And, you know, study after study after study designed to compare the effect, to prove once and for all that, you know, low carb either is or isn't the better way to lose weight. But I've been following this debate now for a couple of decades. And
didn't this start with stuff like the Scarsdale diet and stuff?
Maybe Atkins
and everything. Wasn't he the guy that said just eat a bunch of steak and eggs and
right.
don't eat any bread and pasta?
Cut out the carbs. Yeah, and you will lose weight if you do that. But the question is it more effective than a more balanced diet? And, you know, as I've watched this debate over the decades, I've come to the conclusion that trying to evaluate the merits of a diet or a weight loss program based purely on how many carbs it contains is kind of like trying to review a book based on how many nouns it contains. You know, we really need to know something about the quality, you know, and the content. And I think that the quality of the carbohydrates you're choosing matters at least as much as the quantity. And there was recently a study
there's good carbs and bad carbs.
Right. Huh? And there's the latest of the low carb versus low fat studies demonstrated this pretty brilliantly, actually.
And so what are the bad carbs?
Well, so in this study, they put people on a diet that was either low in carbs or kind of regular in carbs. But everybody on both diets avoided added sugars, what we were just talking about. They avoided refined carbohydrates. That's the stuff made with white flour. They avoided processed foods. They all ate 5 servings of vegetables a day. And they both did great. And one of the groups
both was the low-fat and the low-carb group.
Right. It wasn't really a low-fat. It was sort of a moderate fat. But both groups had basically the same results. And what that tells me is that if you're willing to focus your diet primarily on whole and unprocessed foods and clear out the junk food, it doesn't really matter whether you want to have eggs or oatmeal for breakfast. Whichever works better for you will work. I think the quality of the foods that we're choosing, and especially the quality of the carbohydrates, turns out to be more important.
I always love a good tie. And it looks like we have one here. Monica Reinagle, she's here for Smart Nutrition. She is, in fact, the nutrition diva. If you go to her website, you can sign up for Monica's newsletter and get her nutrition news and tips by email. You can also just call her and talk to her today. 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org. And our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. We will be back in a flash after this little musical interlude from Mr. James Brown.
This is your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR, where you're listening to Midday.
Pass the peas from James Brown. And Monica, I guess you approve of passing the peas, right? Low in carbs and in fat, right?
That's right. Well, they're a vegetable, so they're high on my list.
So it's a good thing. All right. Monica Reinagle, the nutrition diva, is here. We're talking smart nutrition. By the way, coming up later today, theater critic J. Wynn Russick will join us with her weekly theater review. She's going to tell us all about Beautiful, the Carole King musical, which is in resonance at the Hippodrome Theater in Baltimore this week. Looking ahead to tomorrow on the program, it's the Midday News Wrap with Andy Green from the Baltimore Sun and businessman and political consultant James DeGraffenwright. We'll talk about the news of the week, including some thoughts on President Trump's first full week in office. I'm Tom Hall. If you are just joining us, my guest is Monica Reinagle, the nutrition diva. She blogs at nutritionovereasy.com. If you've got some comments, some questions, some thoughts to share about nutrition, particularly this notion of artificial sweeteners and children, we'd love to hear from you. 410-662-8780, midday@wipr.org is our email address, our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So if you're a mom or a dad feeding juice boxes to your children, what do you think? Is that something that's going to be a long-term proposition, or is that something that you might think about revising when it comes to your food strategies for the little ones? Let's go to Barb in Sparks. Barb, welcome to Smart Nutrition with the Nutrition Diva.
Hello, Monica. I'm a longtime listener and a sustainer of WYPR.
Well, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. I actually had a couple things I wanted to pose. When we had our son, I had my son late in life at 38, and one of the first things our pediatrician told us to do is do not introduce your child to any fruit juices. You know, try to keep them on, milk, after they were done with breastfeeding or whatever, and then water. And let me tell you, that really worked. We did not introduce him at all, and then one time he was at a birthday party and somebody offered him a juice box, and he hated it.
To this great
day,
advice.
He's 15 going on 16, he only drinks water and milk.
Great.
And then we do everything balanced with our foods, it's just common sense.
So 15 years ago, your pediatrician was saying, don't do artificial sweeteners.
Absolutely. Just juices, period.
Fruit juice, yeah.
Everything.
Just juices in general, yeah.
He doesn't drink soda, he doesn't drink juice, and we only have soda in the house in case somebody has a bad tummy, that's really about it. Now,
And he's planning to be a hermit and a cloistered monk when he grows up?
Oh, no. He still enjoys a tasty cake. And, it's all about moderation and balance,
sure,
I think.
Sure.
And even when I go to the grocery store, I show him labels. And when I buy cereals, I try to be below 9 grams of sugar.
So have you noticed this phenomenon of seeing foods that are being promoted as being lower in sugar and then finding, because you are a label reader, finding artificial sweeteners in them? Is that something that you've encountered?
Yes. And, you know, I try to do my best because we, even with my snacks, like I'll eat a whole wheat blueberry bar. And I've got to go check that too now because I thought that was healthy now that, but the other thing I did want to ask you as a grown-up, I started using Truvia. Have you heard of that product?
Mm-hmm.
They call it Nature's Calorie Free Sweetener.
Right.
And I only use it in coffee in the morning.
Right. So that is one of the sort of newer generation of non-caloric sweeteners that's made from stevia that I referenced earlier. And I don't know, you can grow stevia in your garden. Barb, if you have a little herb garden, you might want to try planting some stevia this summer. It looks sort of like mint. You can pick it up at the garden store. And if you crush or bite off one of the leaves, you'll see it has an intensely sweet flavor.
So you could throw that in coffee.
You could put it in coffee. Now, I will say that the natural plant, the green herb, stevia, which is so, so sweet, it has some other sort of flavor characteristics as well. A lot of people think it tastes kind of licorice-y. So anyway, that's what they use to make these newer sweeteners, but they're highly refined. They've got to purify all of that other flavor out of there, and you get this this very refined, very sweet white powder that they then cut with other materials to make it a little bit more usable. And that is what Truvia, and there's another one, Purevia. These are stevia-based sweeteners. So this is a more natural non-caloric sweetener than the older school, the Equal and the Splenda. And we don't have as much data on how it affects gut bacteria. The little bit that we have looks somewhat encouraging. It doesn't look like it has the same sorts of negative effects. And so I think if you really need or want to have something like this in your diet, that's probably one of your better choices. But I think that the way Barb is using it, just in a cup of coffee in the morning, not throughout the day in every beverage, and many times, is exactly the way to go about it. You know, let's also keep, I think it's just a good habit to keep sweet stuff, no matter how it's sweetened, to a minimum in our diets. We don't want to be training our taste buds to be constantly expecting sweetness in every bite, you know?
And Barb, your nutritional literacy is a paradigm for all of us. I mean, you've obviously thought about this a lot, and you've been very careful with what you feed your kids and yourself. So that's you are to be commended for sure.
Thank you. Thank you for the information, and I'll put it to good use.
Okay, thanks for your
call.
Thanks
for calling.
I appreciate it. Emily in Baltimore, welcome to the Nutrition Diva and Smart Nutrition here on Midday.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. So I was wondering, I also, kind of like Barb, I've been really careful about what we eat and what I feed my children. I have two kids, 2 and 8 months, and I make most of our own food, but I've been trying to use more natural sweeteners. So that was my question, stevia-based sweeteners, but also using honey and maple syrup, coconut sugar, those sorts of things, dates, that kind of thing. What was the effect of that on kids' diets and our diets?
So those natural sweeteners are much less refined. Things like honey, maple syrup, agave nectar is one that people choose. Everything that you listed. And they are less refined. They do have some trace amounts of minerals. At the end of the day, though, they are still concentrated sources of sugar. So I think it's a fine choice if you want to use those to sweeten things instead of a refined white sugar. And maybe we could classify that as, a slight upgrade. But it doesn't make these foods free or appropriate for unlimited consumption. You still want to, and in fact, the guidelines that we've now been given from the USDA as part of the Dietary Guidelines for Americans are to limit added sugars to 25 grams per day. And in that category, they include the natural sweeteners that we've just been talking about, maple syrup, honey. So use them instead of sugar, by all means. A lot of people really like the more nuanced flavor that you get, but use them in the same quantity that we would recommend using any added sugar?
Yeah, that's a great question, Emily. And thank you very much for your call. And again, it all just comes down to, you know, proportions and portion size of stuff that we're eating and frequency and that kind of stuff. We just got to moderation in everything.
Huh? Yeah, you know, we love this idea of the free lunch, you know, that there's some food that's really yummy and tasty and decadent and it's free. We can have as much as we want because there's nothing in it, you know.
Right.
And I think that we... first of all, those artificially sweetened foods, even if we didn't have the concern that we have about negative impacts, those tend not to be super nutrient dense foods. And so if you are eating them all day long because they're quote unquote free, you know, then what aren't you eating? You know, that's that many servings of fresh fruit or fresh vegetables or something else that actually has some nutrition in it that you're not eating because you're eating these free foods. So, you know, really eating dessert all day long, no matter what it's sweetened with, is just not a path to good balanced nutrition. But what I'm hearing from our listeners is they know this. They're on the right page.
Frank in Aberdeen, welcome to Midday with the nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle.
Good afternoon. I have a question about sugar alcohols. What are they? How are they metabolized? And what is their calorie content?
Sugar alcohols.
It's a great question. These are also very ubiquitous in the food supply and in lower sugar and reduced sugar products. They are neither sugar nor alcohol, at least not the kind of alcohol that we drink, not the ethyl alcohol. They are a naturally occurring sugar molecule that's shaped just a little bit different. And so it's a sugar alcohol and it's metabolized different. It is not absorbed into the bloodstream. So it doesn't cause a rise in blood sugar. And so these used to be go-tos for people with diabetes because it was a natural form of sugar that wouldn't raise their blood sugar. However, they're not entirely calorie-free. There's a bunch of different ones, and you can always tell them because they end in OL. So xylitol, sorbitol, erythritol, anything that ends in OL, those are the sugar alcohols. They're lower in calories. They may only have 1 or 2 calories per gram compared to the 4 calories per gram that we get from sugar. They will not raise your blood sugar. I mentioned before these stevia-based sweeteners are cut with other material to make them more usable. That's what they're cut with. They're usually a mix of refined stevia and erythritol. So you get a low calorie, but not zero calorie, low glycemic impact sugar alternative.
So they are not in the category of non-caloric sweeteners.
They're very low. They're very low caloric, but they're not zero.
So why wouldn't people just use those all the time instead of the other stuff?
Oh, well, that's a very good question. They have a pernicious side effect, and that is that if you eat too much of them, they draw a lot of water into the large intestine, and they give you diarrhea. So if people are over-consuming these things, and you'll see if you read the small print on sugar, alcohol, sweetened foods, you'll see like may have a laxative effect, or even short of that, may just give you a very rumbly tummy. So another thing that we want to watch out for with our kids.
Yeah.
I always try to warn people at Halloween, parents who are scanning the candy aisle looking for something a little less damaging, and they see these sugar-free candies, and they think, well, I could do the whole neighborhood a favor. No, don't do the neighborhood that favor,
not
please.
Not that favor. Yeah. Oh, is it? Well, it's always something, you know, as Gilda Radner so famously said. He's not on the phone anymore, but Chief Falconhawk called from Aberdeen to say, what should we all know about high fructose corn syrup? This is a thing that we hear about all the time, and folks are saying that that's basically just as deleterious as regular sugar, isn't it?
Well, for a long time, people were suggesting that it was far more deleterious than regular sugar. There's been a lot of confusion about high fructose corn syrup, which is... a byproduct of corn. You know, we grow a lot of corn in this country. We got to do something with it. And 30, 40 years ago, they figured out, hey, we could make this into a sweetener that's a lot cheaper than cane sugar, and we can sell it to the food industry. And so a lot of high fructose corn syrup came into the food scape that way. And then about 10 years ago, there was this big scare about it, that somehow it was more dangerous than sugar because it was so high in fructose. The irony is it's actually not higher in fructose than regular sugar to any significant degree. Both sugar and high fructose corn syrup get about half their makeup is fructose, half is glucose. So it's much more similar to table sugar than people realize. It's just a cheaper alternative for food marketing. But the research is in and it's definitive. We don't really have anything to fear from high fructose corn syrup that we don't have to fear from regular sugar. They're basically interchangeable in terms of our metabolism and in terms of our health. Both should be consumed in moderation. To me, it's much more important to me that you're limiting the amount of sugar in your diet than worrying about exactly whether it's coming from high fructose corn syrup or maple syrup or white sugar or whatever. It's the amount that matters.
Yeah, Gert, thanks for that comment and call from Aberdeen. You know, sugar has gone to the top of the list. It seems like it's
public enemy number one.
Hurdled over fat and carbs and everything else as public enemy number one. I mean, yeah. There are lots of folks who are saying just if we could cut out the sugar or you know, decrease it by half or a third, you know, our obesity rates and stuff would vastly improve.
Right. And I think that's because there is, because they are essentially empty calories. They're calories that don't fill us up, don't make us feel full, so they don't keep us from eating other things. They're just kind of piled on top. So they're not satiating. They're very easy to overconsume because they're tasty. They stimulate the reward center. Sugar stimulates the reward center in the brain, so it's hard to stop. That's why there's no such thing as a full bowl of M&Ms on anybody's desk. You know, if they're there, we eat them. So I think that the attention on sugar is well-founded because they're just the primary source of empty calories in the diet. And if we could cut back on those, I think that we could improve our nutrition quite a bit. I, however, am not an absolutist on this. I don't feel like we have to go 100% sugar-free. I think that there's room for a little sweetness in everybody's life. The trick is just kind of keeping that within bounds so that it's not displacing other healthier foods from the diet.
There is lots and lots of room for sweetness in my life and your life.
That's right.
I've been knowing you a long time. And so you always make room for sweetness of the nutritional kind and the other kind. Laurel from Catonsville, welcome to Midday with our nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you feeling?
Very good. I've been enjoying your conversation, and it's something connected to a personal experience for me. When you were talking about drinking only water, and the other caller who said her son only drinks water and milk, and I just wanted to share that I had a kind of a transformation in my life with that. When I was in college, I went to India. I traveled to India for a month as part of a school program. And I was traveling all over the place, so the only thing I could bring with me really was water. And so I ended up just drinking water all the time. And I found I felt so much better drinking only water. And, you know, when I thought back on it, whenever I would have juice, you know, growing up, it was just normal to have juices all around me. And every time I would drink it, I realized afterwards it would make me feel really tired and sort of lethargic. Mm-hmm. And that stopped after I started drinking only water. So now, this is 20-some years later, I'm 43, I still only drink water and milk. And if I touch a juice, if I decide to just try one, it tastes sickeningly sweet to me. And I also feel sick later. And I found I actually have a problem with sugar in general. If I have something sweet, I get fatigued later or I feel just kind of sick. So it's easy for me to avoid it because it does something to my blood sugars. But I have absolutely no weight problem, and I think it's because, I just don't drink that stuff at all. I completely avoid it. And I see, you know, people, it's like addictive to other people. Once you start drinking that stuff, you just continue doing it. And, besides the sugars, there's the chemicals and the dyes in them, and I just wonder what all of that is doing for adults and children combined,
Yeah. Well, thanks for the call, Earl. That's great. That's terrific. And it's interesting, you know, as you're saying, Monica, you can really sort of train your taste buds. I mean, clearly Laurel's taste buds and her microbiomes are trained to really just even repel sugar.
Well, I think this is an interesting point about fruit juice. You know, I think we all grew up thinking that fruit juice was a healthy choice, you know, full of vitamins.
It has the word fruit in it.
It has the root fruit, and you know, it was considered an alternative to, you know, you could eat an apple or you could have a glass of fruit juice. Same, you know, they were considered to be equivalent. And I think one of the big evolutions we've had in nutritional thought is to see that fruit juice is really in no way equivalent to whole fruit, and it is basically just a, you know, extracting the sugar out of the fruit, leaving all the fiber behind, you know, leaving all the stuff that's going to make you feel satisfied, you know, and just concentrating that sugar into a glass. So that has been a sort of a paradigm shift, you know, for most nutritionists, that fruit juice is really no longer seen as something that we want to encourage in kids, in adults. But for a long time, it was considered a health food.
Yeah. Tim in Frederick, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Thanks for taking my call. I actually have a bit of a different situation. I'm 61, and I'm actually trying to gain weight. I've always been kind of slim. I was a long-distance runner. I had the knee problem, but now I can't really run. So I thought, well, I'm going to start lifting weights so I can put some weight on. And I'd like to know what your guests would recommend for diet for weight training where you want to increase weight, but not for some 21-year-old stud, but for some middle-aged guy.
Well, this is something that I've actually been doing quite a bit of work on recently. And, you know, as we get older, whether we're weight training or not, we do tend to lose muscle mass. It's just one of the many indignities that is visited upon us as we get older, as we start to lose our muscle mass. And that translates also if we're trying to gain muscle, we're weight training, it can be harder. So you want to make sure that you're getting enough protein in your diet, and spreading that protein out evenly over the course of the day instead of having it all at dinner time, which is how we as Americans tend to get 65% of our protein. We want to try to get, you know, about a third of it at each meal, and that can help give you the building blocks to build more muscle and get more benefit out of those workouts. And if you're trying to gain weight, you know, there are some healthy sources of calories, things like avocado and nuts and peanut butter, which are, you know, much more calorie dense, can help you put on a little bit more, but from healthy foods.
Well, thank you for that call, Tim. I'm sure you and the one other person in our listening audience that has that challenge are very grateful to you. I appreciate it, and good luck with the weight training. Sorry you can't be out on the road anymore. Let's try to grab a couple more phone calls before we take a break. Pat in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Monica Reinagel.
Hi. I have a question for Monica about something that you said before about the use of diet soda. I'm diabetic, and I drink diet soda, not a lot of it, I don't think. But what is moderation? Is it one a week? Is it one a day? Or something else?
Well, if it's the only source of artificial sweeteners, I would certainly want to keep it at no more than one a day. And by one, I mean like the 12-ounce can, not the 20-ounce bottle, which seems to be all you can buy anymore. I would certainly keep that as an upper limit and, you know, maybe experiment with even going the occasional a day without.
Well, thanks for the call, Pat. I appreciate it. Let's try to sneak a couple more calls in here. Michael in Baltimore, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for having me. My question is about sugar and its relation to chronic disease and inflammation. I've just heard a lot of conflicting reports whether sugar directly leads to inflammation and whether it's connected to the sort of increase in chronic disease Americans are experiencing now. And I was just wondering what your guests thought were on that.
Yeah, good question. And Monica, you wrote a book about inflammation. I mean, is sugar an inflammatory agent?
To the extent that having a lot of sugar in your diet raises your blood sugar, that can provoke inflammation in the body. I don't think it's the single driver either of inflammation or of chronic disease, but I think it's definitely a player.
Monica Reinagel is the Nutrition Diva. She's a licensed nutritionist who blogs at nutritionovereasy.com. If you go to her website, you can sign up for Monica's newsletter and get her nutrition news and tips by email. Come to WIPR.org/midday for a link. Thanks, Monica. I appreciate it. And thanks to everybody who called and tweeted. We didn't have time to get to everybody, but we shall catch them next time.
Always a pleasure.
Coming up, Beautiful, the Carole King musical, is at the Hippodrome Theater. Theater critic J. Wynn Russick is up next with her review. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.